Blog Talk Radio.
Quiet, please. Welcome to Rex Sykes Movie Beat, conversations with filmmakers where we discuss everything film and television. Here on Movie Beat, you learn what to do and what not to do when it comes to making movies and TV, and we will talk to everyone behind the scenes and in front of the camera, and I'll provide you with the guests and the information you're going to want to have, whether you're a filmmaker or a fan. So let's move behind the scenes here at Movie Beat. My guest today is composer, arranger, musician, conductor, Randy Miller. He's joined us before. He scored the movie Yellow Rock. We've been talking about it and so much more. And we're going to be talking with him in just a moment. And I'm really eager to, because it's about making movies memorable with music. And Randy's the man to tell us how to do that. So we'll be having him come up in just a moment. The chat room is open. If you're listening live, join us in the chat room. All of these interviews are available at RexSykes.com. That's my name. That's the official URL of Rex Sykes Movie Beat. It's RexSikes.com. Everything you can listen live right from the interviews blog there. You just click on my guest bio page, find the link inside his biography, click on that, and it'll take you right to the player. Or you can listen anytime 24/7 to the archived interviews. These are all the previous recorded interviews. They're all available right there. There's over 400 hours of professional filmmakers sharing their expertise with you. Randy's got a previous interview there, so you're going to want to go back and listen to that, I know, as well as all of the other wonderful guests, screenwriters, directors, producers, costumers, wardrobe, script supervisors, editors, you name it. You'll find professional filmmakers there giving away the store. You know, they're giving golden nuggets, tips, suggestions, how to, what not to do, and secrets to help you advance your career, make your projects, and be more successful. In exchange, all we ask you to do is share these interviews near and far with all your friends and industry connections. Use your favorite social media means, Google+, Facebook, Twitter, live, you know, face-to-face, on the phone, email, you name it. Share them, spread them. You can post them and anywhere you like. But help us get the word out before the show. We really, really appreciate that. During the show, obviously, live tweets are incredible, you know, and comments. And after the show, so that the people who have not joined us live know to join and listen to the archive shows. Also, one thing that we do ask is when you're listening at the player live or archived, go ahead and leave comments. There's a comment window right under the chat window. And you may not see it, depending on your browser, until after you close your player down. But don't go away without leaving a comment, especially today. And if you're in the chat room, please do leave comments. It means a lot, and it helps us extend our reach to others who've yet to discover the show. All right, so without any further ado, I'm going to bring on Mr. Randy Miller, and we're going to talk about movie music. Hi, Randy. How are you today?
Hey, good morning. Hey, I just listened to your announcements, and I've listened to them before, and it just always strikes me how valuable and great this program is, because you know, filmmaking, and including the music end of things, composers are all over the country now. I mean, it's not just in L.A. and New York, and you know, maybe Chicago and some of the big cities. They're everywhere, and this show and the information is so great to have out to the greater filmmaking community. And I'm finding myself doing films that are based out of, you know, everything from the Northeast to the Southeast to Washington, Oregon area, all over, you know, Texas, everywhere. And it's congratulations. Great show.
Well, I surely appreciate you saying that. And it's people like yourself, my guests, who make the show, you know, what the show is, because it truly is you, you know, who are in the trenches and in working in these movies, wherever they may be. And by the way, the show is international, and there are filmmakers all over the world who listen to the show and make movies from wherever. So, but it's people like yourself who are contributing, you know, and sharing with others, both seasoned professionals all the way down to the newbies, and then the fans of the show who aren't movie makers but who listen because they like to hear what's going on behind the scenes. And so I really appreciate it.
Yeah,
so
my
thank
pleasure.
You very much, and,
it's
great to have you back.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Now, when you were here the last time, we talked about Yellow Rock and some other things. We're going to talk about that, too. But can you catch us up? What have you been doing and working on other things that you could tell us about between that last time and now?
Yeah. Well, there's two main projects that I've been on for the last couple of months. And one is called Sandman, and it's a documentary about a musical that goes has a long, long history going back to the late 50s, and Walt Disney was involved with it. And the documentary traces the story of the musical and where it is today and what's happening. And there's a lot of good people, and including Walt Disney actually sat down with the musical and was scheduled to make a film out of it in the way of a Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, that kind of project. And the filmmaker, Matthew Kalis, has been following this project and wants to do twofold. He wants to make a documentary that follows the story and the history of this musical, and also try to get it onto Broadway or some other live venue. So that's one thing that's been ongoing. I've been orchestrating and conducting the music. We had a couple of big orchestral sessions with top talent out here, and that's ongoing. And then the other project is been arranging music for Julio Iglesias' world tour. The opening act of that tour is a young vocalist named Alexander Kogan. Very good singer, and I've been arranging his show, and the tour's already started, and that's an ongoing project. And the most recent credit, which has just came out, was The Company You Keep, which I also was the orchestrator conductor for. It's a Robert Redford directed film, and that's kind of bringing us up to date from our last talk.
Wow. Well, that's quite a bit, actually.
Yeah, it's been good. It's been good.
Yeah. So you scored Yellow Rock. We're going to go back to that for a second. You scored Yellow Rock, and you have an announcement to make. So why don't we make it right up front and
yeah.
let everyone know what's going on.
Yeah, May 14th is the release date for the score on Entrada Records. It's Intrada, Entrada Records. It's a specialty record company that deals with film music, and they've gotten very successful lately. In the last couple of years, they've really grown. And I've worked with them before on other projects, including Spartacus and Amargosa, a couple of other excellent movies. And you can go to their website, entrada.com, or you can go to Yellow Rock Movie website and listen to some of the cuts and, of course, purchase the CD if you'd like.
Oh, absolutely. So it's entrada.com.
Yeah.
And it's Yellow Rock. Well, let's see if we can play a little bit of a sample here from the main title of Yellow Rock, and then we'll go back and talk about how you do that and how you make movie magic happen with music.
Okay.
All right, awesome. And one of the things, as the music comes up, one of the things that, here we go.
Thank you.
On that is a very, very long opening sequence, which is interesting because it goes on for probably 6 minutes, and it's one of those moments where, as a film composer, we don't often get to write extended pieces of music. They're usually short, anywhere from 30 seconds to maybe 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes, and if you're a concert composer, a classical music composer, a concert composer, you're writing 30-minute pieces or an hour-long symphony or even longer, ballet or opera. So to get 6 minutes is wonderful, and that was a great opening, beautifully shot and filmed and conceived opening sequence to the film. And interestingly enough, right where you stopped, there was an Indian flute. All the instruments are real. They're all acoustic. There's no synthesizers in there at all. That flute that we just heard was a real Indian flute, American Indian flute, playing the melody. But the original version of that, prior to the one you heard when we were recording with the orchestra, I had it on trumpet as well. So it was trumpet and flute. And the idea being that trumpet kind of represented the cowboys and the Western type thing, and the flute represented the Native Americans. But ultimately, we left off. I left off the trumpet because it pushed it too hard towards a kind of a traditional Western, and we just went with the Indian flute, and it sounds kind of neat. It kind of somehow it's a very small instrument, and around it is these giant timps and full strings and low brass. But yet it has a little hole carved in the middle of the orchestration to let that flute come through.
Well, I was, just first off impressed with the flute. I mean, when I first heard it, and even now listening to it, it's kind of this kind of, haunting. And I don't mean it in a ghostly sense, but it has this kind of, lonely, but...
No, but you're right. Haunting is exactly what it was supposed to be as well.
Because,
it was supposed to be that and lonely and all that, because it is the representation in the instrument that one of the instruments we used for the Native American Blackpaw tribe, and that was intentional, and it was intentional to do the haunting. So you're exactly right. The feeling you got was the intended feeling, especially since the next... he's riding down this very steep mountain.
Right.
One of the cowboys, I guess you could say, but the good guy. And after he finishes this very steep mountain ride, he comes across this kind of ghost village. So yeah, you're right about that. That was the intent to set that up.
Go ahead.
Well, no, the thing with the opening sequence, and really any main title, or at least most main titles for a composer, sets the tone for the entire score. And in this case, I spent a lot of time on the main title, decided to do it first because it was so representative of the entire film's musical score, that all the elements, including the flute you just talked about, the big native drums, everything was real, as I mentioned, and they all were characters in the musical score that come up time and again throughout the musical score. Also, right then, I don't know if you picked it up, might have been hard to hear it, but on the phone, but there was a type of lap steel guitar. That was very prominent for the bad guys. It's a type of instrument that guitar players lay across their lap, and they play their hands down as if you put your hands on your lap, as compared to holding it up sideways against your chest. And guitar players have a way of picking it and bending notes and making very low notes very scary. And yet it sounds Western, and it sounds it can also sound kind of period, which this, of course, was in the late 1800s.
Well, it works. I mean, I think Western genre, kind of, especially the old Charles Bronson movies, but, you know, or Shane, you know, you've got this person coming out of nowhere kind of and going to nowhere. You know, there's a lone person in the West who comes in, something happens, and then they go away. I mean, it seems to be just part of the genre when it's made. And you don't know where they're going. And but the music is very captivating. It truly is captivating. And I think I asked you the last time, was this the first Western you've scored?
It is the first Western in terms of a movie from the beginning to the end being Western. But there's been several other films that I've done music for that had scenes that dealt with this kind of genre. They weren't true Westerns, but one was called Pirates of the Plain, which had some scenes in it that had to be done in a Western style, but in that case, it was kind of an inside joke. But still, the music had to be a musical inside joke, because it really wasn't a Western. It was about pirates. But it was set, a particular scene was set in the Old West, so the music had to be authentic, but it was really meant as a joke. And another one called Amargosa, which you've had Todd Robinson, I believe, on your
show. I've had Todd, and I've had Kurt Upton.
Yeah, those guys are amazing filmmakers, and that film was a contemporary film, of course, but it dealt with some music that was in a Western setting. So there's been cases like that where I've done, and others, but not a true Western. That's why this was so much fun, because, I mean, like I've always stated with Lenore and Steve, is that just so much, it's just a great genre for composers, and including, as you mentioned, this ghostly natural sort of supernatural element in this film is also a lot of fun. So yeah, the combination was great.
Well, that's very cool. The thing that, you know, I had asked you about, you know, off air that we were discussing, the notion, and I want to bring it to Yellow Rock, given that this is essentially, you know, a first Western. The larger question is, how do you compose? You know, how do you hear things in your head, and how do you make it, you know, translate that to, you know, paper, and then to, you know, an orchestra playing it, and all those kind of components. You know, how does a composer do what they do, and how do they hear inside their head all the different instruments? But having said that, what kind of all of the music, as far as I'm concerned as a listener, all of the music fits the movie really well. It's really well scored, and it's beautiful music. And and you and they did a marvelous job, you know, with where you bring it in and where it is and where it isn't, and, you know, the whole. But how do you become a Western genre musician, composer?
Yeah, well, you asked,
like,
no,
Native American. Go ahead.
No, those are good questions. There was a couple of questions there, and they're all good ones. And one was kind of, how do you hear it, and how do you know sort of what to do, and all these things. And it's interesting, because if you think back, when I remember being probably 18, and I was listening to jazz, and I was listening to a lot of theater music and Broadway stuff, because I used to go down with my mom into Broadway and see shows and whatnot, and pop music, and, you know, I played classical piano, but I wasn't really deeply listening to classical music, especially more contemporary classical music, that much. And I heard Rite of Spring. I remember putting on headphones when I was probably 18, putting on these cheap headphones that they had then, and listening to Rite of Spring and going, that's Stravinsky, Igor Stravinsky, the Russian composer, and going, oh my God, I have no idea how is this put together? What is this? These colors are just bursting out of my brain cells, you know, with headphones on. Everything is just sort of, as you know, when you listen with headphones, everything becomes this very small world inside your mind because everything else is closed off. And I heard those combinations of sounds. I had no idea what they were. As compared to when you're listening to a Broadway score or some jazz, you can hear the different instruments. You can hear clearly, a sax player playing a solo. As you were mentioning earlier, before we got on the line, you can hear the bass lines and drums. But with a composer like Stravinsky, it was all these unbelievable colors at the same time. And I really didn't know enough about orchestration. I knew very little about orchestration and these kind of things, which leads me to the second part of your question, is how you do it now. Just jumping back to Stravinsky or composers of that era, which was around the turn of the century. He wrote that piece in the very early 20th century. They had no technology. I mean, it was all in their ears and in their mind, and maybe on the piano, just plunking out different parts. But a lot of it was just in their thoughts. And today, and jump 100 years to now, we have all kinds of technology to hear what these combinations of sounds sound like. We have computers and synthesizers and every sound that you can imagine. You can play that sound into a computer and then layer another sound. Jump back 20 years when I started in the early 1990s, around 1988 is when I first did my film score. There was really very little of that, but there still was video players and tape recorders, so you could play piano parts into a tape recorder and layer some basic synth parts. So the combination of sounds has, in the last 10 or 15 years, has the way to do this with different musical technology lets you almost hear all the combinations. So you can layer these parts to get it just the way you want and hear the different combinations. But I also feel that it's so important to have an understanding of how it was done before that time. Like I said, the great classical composers and even the great film composers of 30 or 40 years ago before we had the ability to use all this technology. I mean, there are people like Bernard Ehrman and Jerry Goldsmith and Max Steiner from King Kong, all these people. Anyway, that was a lot of rambling, so I'm not sure I answered your question.
I'm gonna posit something that I have no way of knowing if it's true or not, or if it's just me or anything else. But, you know, I think most people, when they listen to music, unless they're trained, unless they are born, you know, a musician, unless they have an appreciation for all the things, they just hear kind of everything and they get the feeling from it, you know, and maybe sometimes they hear the bass line or they hear the beat or they hear a melody line that they like. But there's so much going on inside of an orchestration. Combination of sounds that are occurring sometimes simultaneously, sometimes in sequence or something to that composing, you know, you're and arranging. I mean, you're putting all these things. It's like making soup.
Yeah.
You know, you're putting all this stuff in, and I have no understanding. I have a great appreciation for it, but I have just no understanding of how that's accomplished. Other than saying that I can get on like GarageBand or something now and as you said, sample and try and put things together and go, yeah, I like that or I don't like that. But to just hear it in your head, you know, where the creation takes place, to me is the amazing, amazing thing.
Well, those are good points. And there's a long history of those instrument combinations, and the history definitely goes back to the classical composers, just what I was mentioned. They go back to, the modern, let's say from Beethoven on, the Romantic period on, all the way up to the contemporary composers. But the combinations, there's certain gestures and ways that strings and the different instrument groups, strings, brass, woodwinds, percussion, there's certain gestures that these instruments play that's been really brought up first through the classical repertoire and then into the film composers world. And then the film composers, and I'll give an example in a moment, but and then the film composers have taken those ways and modified them for film composing and matching action on the screen to what the instruments are doing. For example, strings can be used, all of the strings, the violins, violas, cellos, and basses, they can be used in a way for propulsion and for movement, short bowings, very articulated and quick, and that's been used forever in concert music, classical concert music, and also film composers have used that. And brass has been used, and strings can use many other ways too, but for example, they can be used for the ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta, those kind of very short rhythmic things that push the score forward, which we use a lot in Yellow Rock because it's an action film and these kind of things. In brass, this is the most general terms, have been used for big power, sustained moments where you need something that can hold for a long time and then have a very big swell and a power, and that's been used in opera and the most important symphonic works. It's the way brass, it's a breath instrument, it's the way it's used. It's a very big, powerful instrument, a trombone or a tuba, and those things are big, long bursts, and those will create climaxes and important moments in a very strong foundational way. And woodwinds don't have that kind of power, but they have incredible expression. And when you think of a flute part, like the opening of Afternoon of a Faun, you know, the beautiful flute part that comes down that introduces the piece, and they're colors. Flutes, the woodwinds are color instruments. Strings are not really... they're beautiful color, but they all sound like strings. Like there's a very nice continuity in the type of sound that all the different strings, the violins, violas, cellos, and basses have. But the woodwinds, everyone sounds completely different. A flute sounds so different than a bassoon or an oboe or a clarinet or a sax. So you have colors. So when you want to introduce colors into score, different colors, maybe you reach for woodwinds in percussion, including the piano and harp, are just as you would expect. They're also propulsion and rhythmic. And piano and harp, even though we think of piano playing as maybe by itself, and it can be a beautiful solo piano, in orchestral setting, it's more of a percussion instrument. It fits in that family of support and moving and propulsion and... That's like a little orchestration lesson. And an interesting thing with classical music is all these things that film composers use, including myself, including the great film composers of yesteryear and today, you know, we all reach to what the great classical composers did. We're talking about Beethoven and Stravinsky and Puccini and Wagner and Copland, and all these great composers did these things, and we've taken these things and modified them like say with the brass, instead of just holding a long tone or a very consonant group of notes, composers, and it's not just film composers, but modern classical composers certainly have done this, but film composers might add a tremendous amount of tension in those notes. They might combine the trumpets and the trombones and the tubas in very dissonant combination of sounds that rub against each other and do a big burst. Now it might be a great moment for a scary situation or a sudden change in what we're seeing on screen. I mean, I could go on this for hours, but you get the idea, I think.
Well, and I would love you to go on for hours. This is absolutely fascinating. I mean, you have a lexicon and a grammar to understanding music that the layperson or novice, as I am, certainly both of those, shouldn't even get novice status because I have no clue, can only, learn to appreciate. I have an analogy for my description earlier, about like making soup or what. It's like there are those people who are culinary, their palate is trained, or wine tasters who can sample and take, you know, all these different flavors and comment on them because they're aware of them. They've trained their palate or they have a natural proclivity for that, whereas others just enjoy the wine. They have no idea why it is. It's just a great taste. Mm-hmm. You know, same thing with a meal. And I would venture guess that there's an awful lot of us who just like the music. It does something to us. It makes us feel wonderful, but we don't have an appreciation for everything that goes into it. When you talk about creating tension or bursts to drive something forward or dissonant sounds, I mean, there's a lot of thought that, you know, the average viewer, you know, listener probably never even considers. So when it comes to scoring something like any movie but like Yellow Rock, you know, the amount of thinking that goes into what do we want to have in this moment to move the story forward, or do we want it to pause here, you know, for people to have a rest or a break, or, you know, I mean, it's the degree of planning, the thinking that impresses and amazes me. I know a lot of people, I know a lot of emerging filmmakers who they'll tell me, you know, that they've got a project and they want to play some popular song with it, or they've got a recording and they just slap it on there, kind of like royalty free music, and they slap it on the scene. But it you know, it can help it, but it's not a creative act of making more of the scene, of really telling the story through the sound and through the music.
No, it's very true, and those a filmmaker in this position that you described, just finding something that just works. I mean, they may have to do it because of
right,
financial, you know, reasons, or because they just need to finish the film, or like you said, they just maybe they don't know any better. But it's a real, especially for the aspiring filmmakers out there now, and I'm assuming those aspiring filmmakers are don't have big budgets to work with, because that's just not the case usually. Those guys, and I don't know, this is going to sound so incredibly self-serving, but you know, why not? Music and a score by a good film composer is probably, I mean, I just think about this numbers-wise, financial-wise, it's got to be one of the least expensive ways to make your film so much better. And this was the case with not exactly with Yellow Rock, because Yellow Rock did have a decent budget to work with, but the film still wasn't a big budget film by any means. But if you can take music in a thoughtful and meaningful way, and get it well written and well produced and well recorded onto your film, I think that financially will take you so much further. It gives such a polish, and it raises the level of the film for really very little money when you think about what it costs to all the other elements of filmmaking, getting a name star, and which of course is obviously important, and you know, maybe getting another beautiful set. All these things are important, but money-wise, I think it's very little to do a quality score written in terms of the entire budget of the film, and it raises the stakes so much. Especially in Lenore and Steve, the producers on Yellow Rock, really, we talked about this a little bit last time, but they really came up to the plate, realizing that they didn't have a lot of money in this film to work with, but they knew that they needed to spend the money in getting the score properly recorded with an orchestra on a world-class level, so that it could play in a theater and stand up on its own, and as compared to just playing on someone's computer speakers or on a small TV at home. So it is. And so that fellow you mentioned, the scenario you mentioned, if he could somehow go out and if he had no money, go to some of the music, not only music schools, but go to the film schools, contact, put a sign up, get a composer to do something with the student orchestra or the student musicians, and get a well done score. It's much better than, like you said, just slapping up a song that his buddy did or he found free. And you're right, it happens every day. And these what we call temp scores, the temporary scores on projects come to me all the time when I'm working on a film or I'm thinking about working on a film. The project comes in, I'm listening to it, and just the way you described it, you hear some song that's there, and it makes no sense. It just was put there because somebody liked it, and it had nothing to do too much with the movie. And hopefully that gets replaced at some point.
Well, I want to say that I hope that the sample that we played, given the, you know, the player that I'm working with, that people could hear it and appreciate it. You know, I was listening to it, you know, by phone. I mean, it's not necessarily the best way to listen to it now, however people are listening. But I'm going to encourage people to remind them that Yellow Rock, the score, the soundtrack, will be available May 14th at Entrada Records, which is Entrada.com, Entrada.com, and that they could go and get it and enjoy it, because it is truly, truly a wonderful score, wonderful soundtrack. And your website, before I forget, is randymiller.com, RandyMiller.com. I guess what I, in talking with you and in making movies, more than anything, I begin to appreciate even further how much more the composer is an equally vital storyteller in the motion picture. And I would venture to say that while there certainly are other reasons and other ingredients, that it is oftentimes the score that makes a movie successful and or can catapult someone into stardom as well. Because I've mentioned this before, I think, in either with you or elsewhere. You know, I remember on His Majesty's Secret Service going down the hill, you know, when James Bond was skiing, there was this music playing and you would hear the shushing of the skis. And whenever I would go snow skiing, I would hear this music in my head, because it just, it was almost so completely locked with the notion of skiing that to this day I can hear that music and I don't have to be skiing. That a good score kind of cements together the emotions and the feelings that the actor brings, you know, visually and emotes on the screen. You'd be really hard pressed to separate the feelings that you get from what the actor is doing from the feelings you're getting from how the music is helping you to or enhance those feelings.
Yeah, so that's so true, and there are moments in films that everybody remembers seeing. I mean, it might be some amazing vista or a beautiful love scene, a romantic moment, or a death scene, or anything, any of those things that your eyes see, and it's kind of it's cemented, as you say, in your mind. But the hearing is just maybe even more so, the sounds, and I'm not talking about the dialogue, which,
right,
you know, which of course happens to be important, but in sound effects, which happens to be very important. But we're talking about music here, so that the moments musically, music is one of those strange arts where it doesn't exist really. I mean, you see a painting, you can go up and touch it, and you can see dancers, they exist in kind of life. I mean, you know, there's people dancing and music. It's just these notes, you know, that come out of instruments, and then they disappear. They're gone. They just float. They're gone. They don't exist. They exist for a moment, and they're gone. And I think those sounds, I'm not sure where I'm going with this, but those sounds that you hear, they're in your mind. They're not in your thoughts, like going through your ears, and not something you can register with your eyes and kind of see. And those incredible melodies or scary moments, everybody knows the Jaws, you know, the Jaws, the low shark stuff from John Williams and the Bernard Herrmann, you know, the shower, the shrieking violins, everybody knows these things, these sounds, they kind of cement in your mind forever, and I don't think you ever forget them. If you hear those pieces of music again, it's forever associated with what you saw visually, and you're right about that. It's a very, very strong, very primal connection, and it's probably the most primal because, as we all know, with communication, I mean, when you go back probably tens of thousands of years, maybe not millions, but tens of thousands of years, percussion and music,
right.
Very simple things predated language, and so the sounds of rhythms and the sounds of simple melodies are very primal, and they're going to stick with you. And filmmakers definitely take advantage of that, as well as film composers, and they should, because it's such a, like you're saying, it's such an important element. Yeah, that was kind of a crazy answer, but I think there was somewhere I answered it, hopefully.
I think it's important. I mean, you know, when and I'm going to have to take a break shortly, but the notion is that, you know, there's what happens visually, and we can live with, you know, not so good or okay image, picture quality. Sound, you know, definitely needs to be good, because if you can't hear it, you don't want to, you know, you won't stay with it pretty much, you know, if it's noisy or staticky or there's some irritating sound or the volume isn't right. But the other component with sound in movies is that most of it's synced up. You know, the dialogue needs to be synced with the visual track. The sound effects have precise moments so that, you know, if a gunshot goes off, you know, it should look like it's going off when the gun goes off. But music can precede something and introduce us to how we should feel a moment later. It's the thing that allows us to feel even, you know, a frightening moment that's going to come around the corner before the music becomes frightening, just by how it's introduced. You know, it's a subliminal thing that, you know, and it may linger after other things are, you know, are done. You know, it bridges us from place to place as well. So it's an amazing device, but it's incredibly necessary for.
Well, you just said something really interesting, and a very, very small detail, but it's an important detail. Just for example, in a scary moment, you just said something really interesting. You said it can precede it. When you're doing a scary film or a scary moment in a film that's not scary, but just happens to be that moment that's scary, and either one of them, it's so interesting. The film composers, the filmmakers, have to make a critical decision to make that moment successful, and we all wrestle with it, and we try different things, and there's no clear-cut answer. Sometimes, like you said, you set that moment up musically, like something is going to happen. If you do that, then you're telling the audience something is going to happen, and you're getting them scared, and then maybe nothing happens, so it becomes a red herring. Or you actually, something does happen, and even more scared. Other times, you don't do anything. Nothing. It's complete silence musically, and as soon as that thing happens, that moment happens, either you make the musical event right as the moment happens. You really, if it's a gunshot or something loud, you can't, because they fight each other. So you wait. This is minutia sort of discussions, but it's interesting. You wait a half a second. That's typically what we do, is we wait till after the event. Then we come up with a musical gesture to say, oh, here's what just happened, and really scare the pants off somebody. Or we don't do anything after, and we just let it go silent. Giant build, and then nothing. So there's all these little minutiae ways of handling this, and each one has to be explored with the filmmaker and possibly even tried if you're not sure which way to go. But you're right, and these things, these details are so important in the composer-filmmaker collaboration.
And this is fascinating. I appreciate that so much. We're going to come right back. I'm going to take a break. And before we do that break, I'm going to say it is Yellow Rock the Movie, or yellowrockmovie.com. I keep putting an extra word in there, yellowrockmovie.com. And Yellow Rock, the actual movie, is available. You can get it at local retailers, I believe, like Walmart and perhaps Best Buy and Amazon and Redbox and all over. Check that and check out yellowrockmovie.com. Also, Yellow Rock Movie is on Twitter as well, so you want to follow them. And randymiller.com. Randy is my guest, composer, arranger, musician, orchestra conductor, is my guest. It's randymiller.com. And the soundtrack for Yellow Rock Movie
is at intrada.com, I-N-T-R-A-D-A.com. Get the movie, get the soundtrack, because once you get the movie, you're going to want the soundtrack and or vice versa. You're absolutely going to want to have that. And we'll be right back with you, Randy, in just a second. Please do leave comments whenever you listen to the show live or archived, and please do spread these interviews to all of your industry connections and your film fans and friends worldwide by your favorite social media means or in person. That helps all of us and other filmmakers find the show. Whenever you rate and review the podcast, it increases our visibility on the web as well. And that's what it's truly about. You know, the show is free. We give it away. Guests like Randy are sharing their expertise with you out of the goodness of their heart, and they're sharing this stuff. So all we ask is that you help us promote our guests, help other filmmakers connect with the filmmakers that we're talking to, the professionals, so that they can learn and so that you can advance your careers and your projects and be more successful faster and easier and less expensively. So that's the goal. So help us out with that. Share it and spread the word and rate and review the thing. And then the last thing is to simply leave comments at The Player on Facebook, on Twitter, Google Plus, and your favorite social media means about the show. Live tweets before, during, and after are fantastic, but it helps us get the word out. Upcoming guests, just a few that I will name so that you know, will be Peter Marshall's returning for the Directors series. He's coming up later in the month. Jim McCarns is a TV executive for CBS, many years involved in scheduling and programming. He's has a book out, 101 Ways, breaking into the television industry and developing a career there. So you're going to want to listen to what he has to say about working in professional television. Todd Robinson, who Randy mentioned, director of Amargosa and Phantom, will be coming back, and he'll join us, as will Julian Adams, who is the producer of Phantom and Pendentium, will be joining us too. So those are just a few of my guests that I'm mentioning. Keep in mind that all of my guest shows are recorded and available live. We've done a lot of talking about Yellow Rock. Lenore Andriel and Steve Doucette are the producers. We've done a show with them, and the Spears Brothers, Michael and Eddie, we've done shows with them. Katie Elhoffer is costume designer and wardrober, and we've done a show with her. We've had Daniel Veluve on the show. He runs the Veluve Melody, Veluve Movies Ranch and Melody Movie Ranch set locations out in Hollywood. A ton of experience. Peter Shireko has been on the show. He's an actor and as well has a movies location. So, and Randy Miller. And there's more coming as we discuss the movie Yellow Rock and making movies. So stay tuned and do share. All right, well, we're back with Randy Miller. So,
hi.
Randy, did you and Lenore and Steve know going in that ultimately the Yellow Rock score would become a CD, or did this come about afterwards?
Yeah, I don't think Steve and Lenore thought much about it. I don't think going in, but since I've done many, I've released not many, but probably I think I have five or six, maybe a few more, maybe seven CDs over the years I've released. I thought about it, and but it makes no. There's no. It's the initial thought when you're starting the score. There's no. There's nothing to think about. I mean, I'm not planning anything related around releasing a soundtrack. You're just trying to do the best score you can, given the funds you have and the time you have and your inspiration towards the project. But later, towards the very end of the project of the film, or at least of my portion of the film, of doing the music, which by the way, is almost the last thing that gets done. Almost always is the last creative aspect of the film process that gets done. I started thinking about it, thinking, oh, this would be kind of neat, because they really, like I mentioned, they really stepped up and got me the funds to record this properly. So then I was thinking, well, it'd be great to have a CD, because I'm very proud of the music and the way we recorded everything. It sounds great. And so then you start doing a little bit of prep work from a composer's point of view in terms of there's certain things you do for a CD release. You need to make sure that you have the very, very highest quality recordings of the music available in case there is a CD. So we did all those. It's just planning. It's no big effort. You just have to plan it. And then later, after we finished the music, we talked about it, and Lenore and Steve really wanted to release the CD, and I was all for it. So that's, yeah, so it wasn't planned, but it was thought about a little bit by me, and then those guys brought it up, and we made a plan to make it happen.
Wow, that's really cool. So before we move on, let's talk about some of the other films. Can you name some of the other CDs that you have out there that they can get through Entrada?
Spartacus, you could get at Entrada. That was a miniseries for Universal that I did prior to the Spartacus series that's now on TV. This is a pretty big budget miniseries. Robert Dornholm was a director, and this was recorded overseas with the Bratislava Orchestra. So it's a very big orchestra, 80 people plus, a big score, and that's available. I don't know if Entrada has. They have a couple of other things, including Hermosa. They may have some of those left, but a lot of these things sold out, and I'm not even sure they're available. So that would be two of them. That would be the two to look at at Entrada, which would be Hermosa and Spartacus. And, of course, what we're talking about here, Yellow Rock.
Awesome. Going back a bit, you know, to the notion of storytelling, and we may have mentioned this in the, you know, earlier show that we did, but, you know, like Peter and the Wolf, you know, this
Prokofiev,
musical,
yeah,
you know, this you know, whole story is kind of told just through song. I mean, it's been done before, I'm sure, but it, you know, it's a sample of storytelling and the idea that. Because I think the people think, well, the filmmaker's a storyteller, you know, the director's a storyteller, or the writer's a storyteller, and the actor might be part of the story and all that, but they don't go necessarily as far to realize that this collaborative thing that we're doing, the entire process is storytellers. I mean, you're telling story through sound and through music, you know, when you're scoring a movie, and You first have to come up with the process of, you know, you see the movie and you decide in your head how it might play out sound wise, you know, music wise. So like that opening score, the opening Yellow Rock main theme, and you have the lead character coming down the hill, and you have these different visuals. Having not scored a Western, how did you then create such incredible music that sounds like it should be? You know, West. I mean, it sounds authentic Western music.
Well, Well, thank you for the compliment. But aside from the compliment, thank you for saying that. The main title is always. It's a really tricky, complicated situation for a composer. And actually, typically for me, I'll do. I'm going to answer your question kind of a roundabout way. Typically, the way I end up doing a film, and it's not planned, it just happens this way, is I'll okay, this is a very sort of logistics thing. When filmmakers put together films, in their rough cuts, nothing is set. It's just kind of like, this is maybe how it's going to be. And you're sent over this film. And you don't want to, as a composer, hopefully you're brought on to the project early on, at least when they have a rough cut. Sometimes you're brought on a week before you have the 2 weeks before they're mixing the film, which is horrible. Right. You don't have enough time. But the way to do it for your filmmakers out there is bring the composer on early as you can. For example, when I worked with Oliver Stone on a film and with a recording artist named Kitaro, Japanese.
Sure.
Filmmaker, right? And the we were brought on a year before to do this music, and why not? You're paying the composer whatever you're going to pay him, and why not bring him on early? He can work that much harder for you, and the composer will never argue about that unless, you know, unless for some reason his schedule doesn't permit. But even then, he'll say, great, and he'll make time fit. And on Heaven and Earth, that's the Oliver Stone film, they were smart enough to bring us on very, very early. And so you're getting these rough cuts, and you don't know what to commit musically because you know things are going to change, but at least you can come up with ideas. And the main title is something that sometimes it's set in stone. The filmmaker, even in the rough cuts, knows what they want, but oftentimes it's not. It changes. And the, musically, that's the so important for the film. It sets the tone of so many different characters. You mentioned Yellow Rock coming down the hill. The good guy, cowboy, comes down the hill, so there's music for him, but there's also music, like you said, the flute that's setting up the haunting sound of this sort of strange, cursed town that we see. And then it goes in and sees the same cowboy in his kind of depressed, you know, half-drunk state. And then we see the bad cowboys come in, the bad guys. So all these elements happen, and you're writing. You need to eventually write music that's exactly right for that scene, which is the open titles, but also is exactly right for the rest of the film that can be used and expanded on. So jumping back to the for your filmmakers out there, they've got their rough cut, they have their ideas together, they send it to a composer. The composer then has to decide, am I going to write a main title now or wait until I get a better feeling of what other scenes I'm doing? In most of the films I've done, I actually say to the filmmakers, what scenes, this is early on, if I get hired early on in the process, I say, what scenes are locked? What do you think that you have that really isn't going to change so I can come up with something solid and play it for you? And then you'll give me your thoughts, whether you like it or not. And they give you, okay, this scene, which takes place, say, 15 minutes in, and another scene takes in 30 minutes in, and they go, these are the scenes that we're not going to change. We love these scenes. And I say, which are the most important scenes? Tell me your most important scenes. And then we hone down and find three or four scenes throughout the entire film in the rough cut that are the most important moments, that are very important moments, and I score those. And prior to scoring those, I might start working on main themes, just ideas that I think can really work as a main theme. So I have some kernels of music, some motifs and short melodies, or short, not even melodies, it could be just rhythmic things. It could be like passages that create an environment, atmospheric environment. So I have these little things that I can work with, and I work on those scenes. And then when that's successful and the filmmakers like it, I might score some more of the music of the film and then go back at some point further into the process when the film is locked. And when I say locked, for you guys out there that don't know what that means the film is not going to change. The filmmakers have set the footage exactly, and nothing's going to change lengthwise. There may be some changes in sounds, and even cuts might change within a scene, but the entire length is the same. And so at that point, when the filmmakers have heard these different scenes, then I might go back and do the main title, taking all these different pieces of music I've already written and using it as the opening. So then the opening starts with this music that you're going to hear later on. In the case of Yellow Rock, it actually didn't go that way, which is not normally the case for me. I actually decided to write the main title first. It was such a long sequence, like as I mentioned earlier, instead of a minute and a half, 2 minutes, it was like 7 minutes. So it was really important, and I just felt motivated. It was such a beautiful, interesting scene to work on. That's the way I did that, which is not that usual for me. I did all the themes and got them approved by the filmmakers, and then took those themes and those different atmospheric moments, if they weren't themes, or rhythmic moments, if they weren't, if that's what they were, and then used that in different parts of the film.
Wow!
That's a mouthful.
Yeah, it's just so amazing. I mean, you know, and to think, you know, how critical it is, and to have you know, I mean, just to have someone with expertise on hand to assist the filmmaker in understanding it. Sometimes I think filmmakers don't know what they have even when they have it in front of them. You know, in other words, there's a decision-making process that we're going through and trying to go, do we want to go this way, that way, and we need input. You know, sometimes we're adamant about, you know, it's got to be our way or this way, and we have thought it out, and it may be best for the picture, it may not be. But the notion, I mean, if you take any movie and you put circus music in the front of it, you know, or music that doesn't fit it, you know, is it fair to say that the main title kind of tips it for the genre? You know, it lets you know what genre it is, but as you said, it also sets up the rest of the movie. It can't just be an
open. Yeah, it's fair to say that. No, it's a good question, and it leads me to a lot of different thoughts. That, even though I've been focusing so much on the main title because we're talking about Yellow Rock, there's...
Right.
Let me say this, that there's many great, great films. Well, let's just say there are some great films, not many, many, but there are some great films that have very little music. The film is so strong and so dialogue, the thrust is the dialogue. I mean, it really is that you don't need a lot of music, and perhaps the main title has no music. So there's no, I'm really was talking about Yellow Rock. There's all kinds of other ways of scoring things. Sometimes the most effective thing might be the first 10 minutes, no music, just nothing, just beautiful imagery or really important narration and dialogue. In this case, there was very little dialogue in the first 7 minutes because this is the way this film was structured. There's plenty of dialogue later. So it really depends on the film. And the filmmaker has to, and usually does instinctively know that. I mean, they know that if, and more than instinctively, you just can watch a film. There's no music, and it's just riding down a hill, and there's some sound effects. There's something missing. I mean, it's just probably not going to work, so you want to get that score in there. Now, however, if this started as a, let's say this film started with the Native Americans, you know, sitting around discussing very quietly the history of, you know, this their tribe or something, then the opening titles would be very different. You might not have any music. Maybe you'd just be listening. And then maybe the music would come in at minute three instead of minute one. So, you know, you got to trust your filmmakers that they're going to come in with valuable insight and logical stuff. I mean, it makes sense that what I just said, that, you know, filmmakers would naturally know that. One funny story, maybe when you were asking the question, made me think of a filmmaker, and I won't mention his name and I won't mention the film either, but he came here, he was the producer actually, not the director. It was a thriller, and he came to my studio, and most people know where middle C is on the keyboard. It's about halfway up. A piano keyboard is 88 notes, and, you know, it's about note 44, more or less, halfway. And this is a horror, kind of like thriller, and he says to me, okay, I don't like low notes. And he took his hand and played middle C and then dragged his left hand all the way down to the end of the keyboard. No notes below middle C for your score. And I'm going, okay, well, that's this is a thriller. You know, I'm thinking this is silly. So, I mean, it's just, but this is a filmmaker who I couldn't trust. I mean, for what his
right.
instincts were. Yeah, of course, I used plenty of low notes, and he loved the score. But thank God I hadn't cut out all the low notes of it. So you have to trust your filmmaker that they know what they're doing. And if you feel like they don't, then you know, maybe you can work with them and explain to them and show them how something might work that they may not think it does. And the opposite happens too. You know, you might compose something, and it's happened to me, of course, that wasn't what they wanted. I thought I understood what they wanted, and I did something, and they didn't like it, or they wanted it modified and changed. And then you know, it's a back and forth give and take. And that's the way it should be with a creative collaboration.
Wow, well, this is very cool. Well, yeah, no, I didn't mean that all movies start with music in the beginning, because it doesn't. But is it fair to say that whatever the opening music is, it does service to the genre? I mean, in other words, like I said, if I take, unless this is some artistic choice, and or there's another reason for music to be playing in the beginning, like, you know, it's the radio on a car or an alarm clock or something,
yeah.
Or, you know, but that the score, in other words, if it's a horror movie, I'm probably starting with something that lets me, the audience, know pretty much what it is. If it's a Western, I'm starting with tones and sounds that make it what it is. I'm not starting with, you know, like World War II music. I mean, you know, there's war movies and action movies, and I mean, there's all these different genres. Is that a way to think about it, that the music needs to do service to the genre so that the audience at the same time isn't confused in the...
Yes, that's a really good point. I see. Yeah, that point is well taken. Yes, it is. And you don't want to, you want to keep it honest. Yeah, I mean, the music it should reflect what the film is, because if you start with something and it's not what the film is about, it's almost like a trailer. You know, you see trailers and it's really misleading the audience, because you think you're going into seeing some kind of film, but it's really another. When you see the whole film. And the same thing with the music. Yeah, you're absolutely right. You do want to keep it honest to the genre and the kind of film that will unfold in front of you. And the main title, or somewhere close to the main title, you know, like you said, it could be, you know, you're right. It, of course, could be a few minutes later. Whenever the music does come in, should be reflective of where the film is going. Sometimes there's a real abrupt change in a film, as we all know. There might be,
right.
It might start off, you know, as a beautiful love story, romantic, wonderful, and then turn into something very sad.
Right.
Well, then, you know, then the music is not going to start off sad. It's going to start off with a warm feeling, but that's just following the structure of the story, and then it makes a big change later, and then maybe, you know, Without Limits was a film that I scored for Robert Towne. Tom
mm-hmm.
Cruise produced it. And it was a big budget Warner Brothers film. And in that case, it was about a runner, who Olympic level runner, who had all these fantastic accolades and things that he did. And then he dies at the end. And anybody who knew, it's real life, it's a true story. Anybody who knew the story of Steve Prefontaine knew that he died in real life in a car accident. It's terribly sad, terribly sad. But the story doesn't start that way. The music starts very Olympic kind of sounding and exciting and upbeat, just the way you'd expect a long distance runner story to start. But then there is a huge change 2/3 of the way in, or 3/4 of the way in, when he actually dies in the end. It's very sad. So in that
right.
case, is an example of how it can change, but still the music was within the storyline at the opening.
Well, I guess, yeah, I mean, you've given great examples, and one that had come to mind, you know, earlier was, you know, unless there's a certain convention, like say Dusk to Dawn, where it starts off being what you think is just a suspense film and it turns into a, you know, a monster movie kind of thing. You know, there certainly might be changes in the music, but what you just, you know, like we said, a romance that starts off light and then is very sad, or like love story, I guess. But I'm looking at a general thing here. But overall, the music that you use for the movie when you conceive it is within like. A romance movies,
yes,
genre.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah. Within the
even
the,
if you're in bed, it's there's something about it that lets you know this is not, you know, a scary movie. It's not a comedy. It's not a, you know, an action flick. It's this is going to be a love story.
Yeah, and that you're right, and it's a composer's responsibility and hopefully their skill to do exactly what you just said, to make sure that it gives that emotional support exactly as the filmmakers intended, and or it confuses the on occasion, you can also do the opposite, as
right.
we discussed. You might have, you know, no music, or even you know, even some, let's say, let's going back to the scary moment, you could have the opposite kind of music, some big band music that's playing on a radio that's uh-huh. kind of upbeat and kind of like, oh, everything's okay, and then boom, you know, all hell breaks loose. But yeah, whatever it is that you're doing musically, it's up to the skill of the composer and the collaboration with the filmmaker that's planned out. And like you said, it really has to be it has to be true to the story, so that for the audience, the intent, what happens when the audience listens to music is what the filmmakers want to happen. And so, like, that's what you just said is interesting, because when I was working with Steve and Lenore, and really most filmmakers, for your filmmaking community, when I asked them, when we talk about the music and what the music should be in a scene, just what you were asking about, that I typically don't want to hear from them, oh, I want French horns, and I want strings, and I want C sharp minor chord here, and I want
and no low note.
Yeah, low note. None of that stuff. Really, what I want, and I ask them, and sometimes it surprises them. I say, what do you want the audience to feel, or what do you not want the audience to feel? Maybe you don't
right.
want anything. Well, then, musically, then silence would be the best thing, or something very neutral
uh-huh.
in the music. But really, I'm asking them, what do you want? What do you want the audience to feel? Because I can help with the music. I can help subtly suggest that, or very strongly suggest it, as you said, with your idea of, you know, having that music kind of build in that scary moment, and everything in between. If I can get dramatically what the filmmaker wants, then I'll have a better chance of being successful. And when a film comes to me, in a particular scene in a film comes to me, if I don't know what's going on in the scene, then as a creative person, then usually there's something wrong with the scene. And, you know, if it's not kind of obvious even without music, there's got some problems there. But that's okay. Sometimes composers can help in that. Sometimes they can't, but oftentimes they can clear up that or help out where it's needed. Maybe the director didn't have another chance to get another take to get it just right with the actors, or any numerous things can happen. And the composer, I'm kind of going off different places here, but composer, it's interesting because we come in at the last minute, like I mentioned earlier. We come in after the rough cut is done, sometimes after the final cut is done, and then the only thing that's happening between the final cut and the final mix, where you bring in the music and the dialogue and the sound effects, the only thing that's happening in that interim is usually the colors are changing, you know, doing picture coloring so that everything conforms, and they're doing some sound effects, which of course is important, maybe some dialogue replacement. But the big element that comes in at the last minute is the music. So that's a moment that the composer can really alter what's going on, and comes in with a fresh eye for the filmmaker. So it's the last kind of creative person coming in, adding something, hopefully not the last minute, but oftentimes, to what you were saying, it's a chance to make sure that the dramatics are happening the way the filmmakers intended.
Again, this is, for me, this is very riveting, and I'm sure it is for our listeners as well. I'm going to abruptly change the topic here,
yep.
and I apologize for doing that,
please.
But I'll tell you why. One, I'm going to want you to come back, and we'll talk about orchestrating and working with, you know, musicians and things like that at another time, if that's okay with you.
I'd love to.
Right now, I think I have good news. I think I can get some of the music that I've been waiting to process up, and I'd like to play a sample. I'm going to start it now, and maybe you can talk about it afterwards, and let's see if it plays. I could be wrong about this, but I'm going to try and play Hanner's Dead and find out if we have music coming. Sounds like something's starting.
Yep.
Maybe not. Oh, well. There we go.
There it is. Thank you.
I gotta say, I'm sorry that it cuts off, but I got to say that I have no control over volume or sound. I have no idea how it's going out over the player, and I hope it's as sounds as good as it does, you know, when you actually have the CD, you know, because I have the movie, you know, I can listen to it, but I don't know what it sounds like over the player, so I hope that the listeners get a decent hearing of it.
Well, that was an interesting scene. Do we have time to talk about that scene a little bit?
Yeah, we've got you know, like about 8 minutes. I can, you know, well, next time if I can, we can play Gold to Dust, or I can give a sample of that later, but for now, yeah, we've got about 8 minutes at the top.
Okay, that was a scene where Dr. Sarah, one of the lead characters, that's Lenore Andrill, that was her character. It was a very dramatic moment where she's realizing that her friend, Hanner, she believes he's dead. And one of the bad guys tells her that, and she's shocked. So what's tricky about scenes like that, and this was a real pleasure, Lenore did tremendous work in that scene. The whole scene was close up on her face, basically telling the story of what's been going on. So what's interesting about those type of scenes where you have a focused person close up in a camera, the music in this case had to be dramatic, had to kind of be a storytelling element. So even though, let me try to describe this correctly, you could take that music and you could put it in in another scene that had some action to it or some movement to it. But in this case, it was all... what I mean to say is the music could go to some visual... you could imagine that music, something happening on screen visually. Uh-huh. Because, in fact, I used similar music to that in a prior scene, which is when the Native Americans are going through this burial ground, this kind of haunted burial ground where you see these apparitions and scary things popping up in images, and it's very scary. And in this sense, I was playing the psychological aspect of Dr. Sarah's speech rather than the visual. So there was nothing to see. The music was playing what she was saying and the psychology of what she was saying. And with something like that, there was some elements like the low drums were the same drums you heard at the opening of the film. The flute came in, the same Indian flute came in kind of a... she was talking about the curse in that scene, and so that had a dissonant sound to it, the flute, kind of a spiritual, kind of Native American sound. And behind that was these sustained strings that we were talking about before, where you had dissonant clusters of sustained strings. You had, if someone went to the keyboard and you played a C and a C sharp, a D, an E flat, E, and you played what's called a cluster, a bunch of close notes, and you sustain them in the strings, this is the background of that, of the support of that music. And the idea was that she's telling the curse. My thought was I wanted to make sure that the audience that was watching, the listeners watching the film, would hark back to when the Native American, when the cowboys were riding through the bad guys were riding through the graveyard, because that's what she was talking about, the curse that the Indians were putting on these bad guys, and how it was affecting them, affecting their everything they do from that moment in the film onward.
That's really, really, very cool. I'll tell you what, let's see if we can play a little bit from the Gold to Dust and have you describe some of that in the remaining And again, it just abruptly ends. Wish you could fade it out. It'd be a little smoother.
Well, that's okay. That is almost the opposite that of the prior scene. In that case, that also is a very long cue. It's close to 10 minutes. It was even longer than the main title. So it goes, goes, and goes. That was about halfway through the scene where it starts, and it builds much, much bigger than where we let off. It goes for another 3 or 4 minutes to a very, really the biggest climax with the full orchestra playing and big brass. And this is when the last of the bad guys comes to his end. And the reason that's the opposite is in the prior scene with Lenore, there was a wall-to-wall dialogue, and so I was supporting her dialogue. And this, there was no dialogue. It was just these beautiful open landscape showing these Native Americans on horseback and this one bad guy through these big open fields. So I had a lot of room to do whatever I wanted musically because there was no dialogue and there was nothing that I needed to work around except make sure that the emotion was correct. And in that case, it opened up with guitars, multiple layers of guitars, and some of the lap steel guitar I mentioned earlier, and a little bit of the flute. And right after where we stopped it, the strings and the brass came in for this big, we were talking about the climax with brass and horns. As the last guy is about to meet his end, there's a big push in the brass. They're just building, doing these rhythmic pushes. And finally, the horns and the trumpets and the trombones and the contrabass trombone, a huge trombone, a contrabass trombone. It's a fascinating instrument. It's giant. It's like a giant trombone. And they come in and add this incredible power in the low end and push, and they push, and they push. And the strings are pushing, as I described earlier. And that scene goes on. And it was a great scene for a composer. It was like just what you want. You want these big open moments and, I'm just joking, but get rid of that pesky dialogue. Of course, I'm just teasing. Get rid of the dialogue. Let the composer have his moment. And that was my moment in the film, more so than any, because it was just this, like I said, this beautiful setup and the way it was filmed and written. It was just a great moment for a composer to have his little moment to shine, on his own, very little sound effects and mostly music driving the whole thing.
Wow. Well, it's so fascinating. Absolutely. I love what you do. I'm amazed by what you do. I can't even begin to fathom it in my own head. I mean, I'm sorry.
You're very generous. Thank you.
No, I'm not being generous, but it's just so amazing. I so appreciate you being here and sharing this with not only me, but our listeners. Like I said, I want to get you back. I want to have you back and talk more about orchestration, even talk more about how you know what to do and when, when it comes, whatever, you'd like to talk about. Maybe we can get you back even before the soundtrack comes out, if that's doable for you.
Yeah, that would be great. We'll set something up. Thank you.
We'll talk in a moment and see what we can accomplish that way. But I just want to say I have been thrilled to have you here. The music is gorgeous. People should go get it. They can get it at Intrada.com. It's Intrada.com. Beginning, I believe it's the 14th. It is the 14th, but I believe that's next Friday. But they can go to the website now. They can get Yellow Rock, the movie, at yellowrockmovie.com. So they can get both the movie and soundtrack will be available. Then randymiller.com is your website, randymiller.com. And, of course, Yellow Rock Movie on Twitter. They can follow there, too. Randy, it has been indeed a great pleasure having you here today. Thank you so much. And I wish you a great rest of the week and a fabulous weekend. And I'll talk to you in just a moment. But thanks for sharing what you do so well with the listeners and I.
Total pleasure. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks. So there you have it. A fascinating guest, Mr. Randy Miller. Again, randymiller.com. Go check out his website and go check out Intrada Records, the music at intrada.com. Get Yellow Rock. The soundtrack, and if he has other music available there, check that out as well. You'd be glad that you did.
And I want to thank you, my listeners, and the readers of Movie Beat for loyally supporting the show, tweeting about it, Facebooking, Google Plusing it, using your favorite means to spread the word. Please keep doing it. It means a lot to me personally and to my guests, and it means that other movie makers and filmmakers and fans can discover the show, because it ups our presence on the internet whenever you do that. So please do. Share it with everybody. You can repost these interviews, you know, on your walls or other walls, but get them out there. And please do leave comments whenever you listen live or archived at the player. If you don't see it right away, wait until the player closes down. It's usually under the chat room window if the chat is open. If not, the comment window is always there. Whenever I open up the player, I always see the potential for leaving a comment. So please do, whether live or archived, rate and review these podcasts as well. You can follow me on Twitter at Rex Sykes Movie BT. The last word is abbreviated. It's just a BT, Rex Sykes Movie BT. There's also a Rex Sykes Movie Beat YouTube channel and Rex Sykes Movie Beat Friends on Facebook. Go to Facebook, go to the Friends page, friend it, and that way you'll always find out about upcoming interviews. There's a sad part about the Friends page, and that you got to visit. Facebook has changed the game. You can't get to all of your friends. It's only those people who apparently visit can see it. But that's one of the ways that I get the words out about my upcoming guests, about the schedule that we're keeping while my official website is under construction. I haven't put up any construction banners. It's just been for the last 2 years been under construction. I don't do a lot of reading or writing of blog pages or promotion on that website. All the interviews are current. You can always get all these interviews. Randy's previous interview with me and over 400 other hours of programming, professional filmmakers sharing their expertise with you right there at the interviews blog at RexSykes.com. So, all right, everybody, have a fabulous day. Make your movies and complete your projects. Until we meet the next time, that is a wrap.